Welcome to the session, ladies and gentlemen. Both our presenters, Diane and Peter, work for Deloitte and are consultants with extensive experience in superannuation. Today they will discuss some of the challenges facing the superannuation industry. Peter, you're going first?
Yes.
Please.
We've got a small enough group, I think we'll keep it fairly informal. We might, perhaps we'll press on through and keep questions till the end, unless there's a real burning question, because I can imagine we could get tangled up in some numbers and not make it through to the end if we don't press on. So perhaps we'll leave plenty of time for questions and do that at the end. Our presentation today is going to give a bit of a recap on some of the key takeaways from our Dynamics of Super report, which some of you may have seen. It's on our website if you want to look at it in more detail. So we'll touch just briefly on that to give you a bit of context. But then the bulk of the report is we've done some more modelling, some updates and enhancements to that, and looking at it more from the individual's perspective and how it interacts with age pension and those sorts of longevity and adequacy type questions. So we'll spend most of the time on that, and then we'll circle back a bit at the end to maybe put a few thoughts out there as to how some areas for improvement in the superannuation area. So a very quick snapshot just of our report for those of you who either haven't read it or has been a while since you've had a look at it. So we'll get to the numbers in a second, but the superannuation overall, what we do in this superannuation Dynamics of Super report is we model the whole superannuation sector, if you like, and we break it down into segments and things and do project it out for the next 20 years, of course, using a whole bunch of assumptions. We'll only go into some very high-level numbers on that today, and there's heaps more detail there if you want to go and have a look at it. But so over the last 5 years, even with a GFC and with the limitations that we have around people being able to make contributions and all sorts of things, still saw some significant growth, up to $1.6 trillion. And our projections say that will continue to keep growing rapidly to about $7.6 trillion 20 years from last year when we did this study. We'll go more into the numbers, but the post-retirement segment hasn't grown probably as much as we would have thought, and it's quite a topical topic at the moment, and a whole bunch of reasons, you know, maybe due to that. A lot of super assets leave the system, of course. You look at the APRA stats, around about 80% of all benefit payments from industry funds leave the superannuation system, and I think it's about two-thirds if you go across the whole industry, including retail and the corporates and what have you. So still a lot of money leaving our sector. There's also people who do put it into post-retirement, taking maybe more than minimum level, drawing it down quicker, all those sorts of things. So anyway, overall, superannuation growing quickly, but the post-retirement sector probably hasn't grown as much as we might have expected. And the last two points there, which will be very topical, and we'll go into more detail about the demographic forces are clearly massive. Aging population, and we're still seeing benefits at retirement not to the level to live on a sustainable income for most Australians. So for all the good things the Australian superannuation system gets big ticks for, and there are lots of those, there's still clearly some work to be done to improve until we can get to a more sustainable solution. So here's some numbers. We'll just go on this. So this is essentially the chart projecting it out to that $7.6 trillion or thereabouts number. Little blip there around about GFC. This one does allow for SG increasing to 12, and I think it's also the getting up to 12, the quicker one. So the not deferred for 2 years, although I think it only changes it by about 1% or something, whether it's deferred for 2 years or not. This is exactly the same chart, but splitting it into pre and post retirement assets. So the green being post retirement and the blue being pre retirement. And then showing the growth to the 7.6 trill. I suppose 2 points there. The post-retirement does grow a lot. You can see from 20 years from now, essentially the green bar's as big as the total bar now, so well over $1 trillion in post-retirement in 20 years' time. But as a proportion, we're still not, based on our projections anyway, we're not seeing that grow predominantly, you know, proportionately larger, the post-retirement compared to the pre-retirement. It's still, you know, the blue bar's about four times as big now in 20 years' time, and the green bar's about four times as big in 20 years as it is now. So they're both growing, but we're still, even though with an ageing population and the 12% into super and all these things, we're still not seeing that green bar get hugely bigger relatively. Here's just a few charts on those demographic forces, and just showing working population. I'm not sure how clear they are to you, but the on the left three pie charts is the working age, broken into, you know, generation X, Y, Z, and the baby boomers. So in 20 years' time, essentially 80% of the working population will be Y and Z, and still a few X's like myself in there. The next middle row of bars is the retired group. So now showing 32% of the boomers are baby boomers. Retired, but that increases down to nearly 60% by the time you get to 2033. So it's just showing those things that are quite well documented in another way. The third row of column of pie charts is just a ratio of working to retired. So showing that the 80% now population working is falling to 73 20 years from now. So quite a significant change, as has been documented. I'll keep moving through these fairly quickly because we'll get to some numbers in a minute. So this is just starting to move now from looking at the overall superannuation sector to getting down into more what this means for individuals. And again, we've done some modelling here where some of you may be familiar with the ASFA retirement standard. So numbers in that table are showing what ASFA publishes regularly as both modest and comfortable living standards. So how much they believe is how much we need to live, either modest or comfortable. Probably some of us in this room may even say that the comfortable is fairly modest, but we'll just use the stuff that's published. So the table, the little graph on the left, is assuming that you draw down modest from age 65, starting from essentially the average balance of a 30-year-old now, which is only about $25,000-$30,000, growing with, you know, fairly much standard salary, 12% SG. I think it's about a 6% return, so not a huge return, fairly balanced return, if you like. So that's growing to about $1.1 million in future dollars, not real, by age 65. And if you draw down at the modest level, according to the ASFA standard, that'll last you till you're more than 90. But drawing down at the comfortable level, so the $42,000 for a single person, and that's indexed out to allow for the future dollars, that's not even allowing, not even lasting till 80. So although the 1.1 sounds like a big number, it's still showing that our retirement outcomes are not quite getting to where they need to for most people. So not surprisingly, when we issued this report, this was almost the main chart that all the journalists jumped onto straight away. It was nothing like there's an ageing population, the superannuation system has issues, or longevity, all these things. It's $1.1 million isn't enough to retire on. So that was all the headlines in the financial press that came out of our report. I'll keep going. The next one...
Just on that one, does that include the age pension?
I've got a whole bunch more slides coming up which do. This one, yes, this is just purely using superannuation drawdown. The next slide just looks at if you push out the retirement a little bit more, and again drawing down at the modest level, so your 1.1, you know, is getting up to 1.6 if you keep working to 70, and then that'll last you till about nearly 90. So... Five years extra work gets you 8 or 9 years of extra superannuation, living in retirement, if you like. And we'll come back to those and how that links into the pension soon. But just before we do, we'll try to try to just sort of stop for a second and say, so what might we be looking at 10 years from now? A sort of a snapshot of the industry, but very much looking at the just that retirement question, not more broader superannuation questions like modern awards and things like that, which are not so much retirement focused. But our projections would show roughly $3 trillion of assets and $500 billion of that in post-retirement, 70% of the super system with Generation X, Y and Z, compared to about 45 now. Life expectancy for 65 is 86 for males, 89 for females, allowing for sort of similar levels of improvements as we've seen in the past. Around 80% still receiving at least a part age pension. The modelling does start to show that there's less people taking the full age pension, but still a very heavy reliance on the pension. Average balance for a 65-year-old in an industry fund projected to be about 200k, a little bit less for females, a little bit more for males, but that's based on current average balance for a 55-year-old with contributions, average salary and some interest. So that's telling you that now the average balance for a 55-year-old is well under 100,000. And the ask for a comfortable retirement standard index from now to for 10 years is about 720k, we estimate, allowing for indexation. That's for a couple. It's about 100,000 less than that for a single. So there's still quite a gap there. And we're still only seeing an awful lot of Australians retiring on about 200k 10 years from now. We break this slide into probably and possibly. I possibly should have called the possibly hopefully. So we've put down some points there. Hopefully in 10 years' time, people are retiring later. They're more engaged and taking a greater interest in their retirement and possibly making higher contributions. Government's put through some regulatory changes to help address some of these perhaps disconnects between the pension and super funds and all that sort of stuff. Post-retirement products are more advanced and gaining traction. We'll talk a little bit more about that later, and I had to throw in one, possibly another market correction as well. So I think now I'm going to hand over to Diane, who's going to take you through a little bit more of the modelling that we've done. And that starts to allow for age pension and those sorts of things.
Thanks, Peter. So what we're starting with is using the same 55-year-old now retiring in at 65 in 10 years' time, and what does that look like? So this first chart is saying wanting to target a comfortable level of income. So what we've done is we've worked out, got that $200,000 balance, solving for how much do I really need to draw down, knowing that I'm also going to be able to get a bit of age pension from that. So the green section is the age pension and the blue is the rundown of the super. And so what we can see is you start off and you're probably getting about half of that comfortable level of income from your super drawdown and the other half's coming out of the age pension. But then your super runs out by about age 74. So if you compare to if you didn't have any age pension, it would run out at 70, so you've got about another 4 years of making your super last and be able to have that comfortable level of income. But then after that, super's run out and you're back to a modest level of income. In fact, if you have a look, it's just the age pension, which is just below that modest dotted line there. And we've also got lines here that show the life expectancy for the males and females. So males at about 86 and females at 89. And we can see that super's run out well before the life expectancy, so people are not going to be able to sustain their comfortable level of income for that period. The next chart's the same thing, except we've also allowed for having some other assets, so about 200,000 of current dollars worth of assets in future, and so therefore be able to get some income out of that, and then that means that the individual starts off with about 24,000 from the income on those other assets, plus about the same amount from their super, and there's about 34,000 from the age pensions. That then gives where they start off to get the comfortable level income at retirement. And then the proportion of super is going to drop down over time because their super balance is running down over time. In this case, the super is going to run out at about age 79, so we've got about an additional 5 years by having those other assets and then be able to not have to draw down the super so quickly, but still running out before the average life expectancy. So just out of interest, we've done what would it be for a modest lifestyle, and because of the interaction between super and age pension, the person would be able to draw down a small amount from their super and get a large amount from their pension. And in fact, there's no way to only get the modest level of income with that level of super balance, because you can still draw down. You have to draw down minimum and get your age pension, and you end up being slightly more than modest, but at least that's probably a bit better than being under modest. And the other thing is the super balance doesn't run out even by about age 100. I had a look and it's about 28,000 in current dollars that would be remaining of that original 200,000 that had been invested in super. So well beyond life expectancy, but one of the things around that then is that the age pension has been sustaining that, and how has the interaction between the age pension and super really worked? Has the person really, I guess, depend on the taxpayers too much? So this chart is really just the same information as we just looked at, but how quickly is that super balance running down? So this is based on the comfortable lifestyle, because it's not really makes sense to do it on the modest lifestyle. And so each of the lines, the solid blue is really if you're not drawing down any age pension, the super running out around that 74 mark. Sorry, it's about 69. I don't know why that is. Then with the age pension allowed for, it's 74 and then 79 when you allow for the other assets. So if we turn to the 30-year-old today, and what would it be like for them retiring at, say, age 65 in future, again wanting to target a comfortable level of income. So same case, looking at, you know, average 30-year-old salary and average balance in super now and projecting with SG, etc. What we see is probably about 70% of the income would come from their super drawdown and about 30% from age pension. So this is really saying that people are going to still be dependent on the age pension, at least in part. And again, you know, I can draw down a bit less from my super because I know that I'm going to be able to get some age pension and the interaction between those. In this case, super lasts to about age 89, which compares to the about 77 if there was no age pension. So we can see that it makes it last a lot longer. And very good, it actually lasts past the life expectancy for the male, and it's about in line for the females as well. The important thing with this is it's just based on those life expectancies that we expect for the next 10 years. We haven't really allowed for future life expectancies. There's improvements. Because there's a bit of debate about whether or not mortality will continue to improve just with the lifestyle factors and obesity and things that we're having these days. So we haven't got into that, but it still doesn't affect, projection just affects where you think that you're going to have to live to. And of course, remembering that half the people will live past average, so that actually means that probably about half the people are not going to be able to sustain that comfortable lifestyle for their full remaining life. So same thing, adding in other assets. So again, we're not making a call about how much other assets are, but just to illustrate, so this is again saying that someone's got about 200,000 in current dollars, so whatever that would be equivalent to by the time that they retire in 35 years. And so in that case, probably at 60% of the income is going to come out of super, 30% from the other income, and so there's a smaller reliance of about 10% on the age pension to start with. In this case, the super will last to about just after the 98th birthday, so well past the average life expectancy. And the individual has really been supported in part by the age pension throughout the entire period since their retirement.
Diane, sorry,
yeah.
Question.
Yeah.
What's the, is it still 6% return assumption?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, so... you can look at whether or not you would have a different... what we've done is just 6% throughout, so there's a slight implicit probably assumption that you've gone a little more defensive because of the tax-exempt status, but it's just really an illustration.
Just to is the other assets are in super or they're outside?
So the other assets are outside super, so the super balance is just that dark blue section at the bottom.
And they're only 6% after tax?
I think we've got the same assumption for all the assets.
Thank you.
Sorry, I think I did this good one. So again, this is just the same thing, illustrating what the super balance looks like as opposed to the income stream, and seeing that it's about age 77 if there's no pension, but once the age pension has been allowed for, it goes out to about 89 and then to 98 if there are other assets being held outside super. And so I guess you can get into whether or not there are debates about having to try to have, when people have got a large home that they're living in, whether there's some amount of trying to use some of that capital maybe to support the individual in their retirement so that they can live on a reasonable level of income for whatever they're looking for. So moving on, this is a chart that I pulled out of the Treasury modelling from last year's budget papers, which looks at the age pension. It's probably information that you already all know, and it's very topical at the moment. So about 50% of people are full rate pensioners currently, and about another 30% are part rate pensioners, so at least 80% of people are getting at least a part pension. By 2027, it's projected that the proportion of full rate pensioners will decline, probably about 20%, but the proportion of partial pensioners will actually increase by about 20%, so you still end up with about the same proportion of people getting the pension as are currently, with the only about 20% of people not being eligible for any age pension. Obviously, the introduction of the measures that the government's announced and what may happen in future is a bit uncertain about where things will end up going on with this, and I guess it's also how good is the Treasury modelling at looking at this. One of our clear messages is that you really have to look at both the age pension and the super together. You can't look at one in isolation because they really are dependent on each other about what people are actually going to be able to sustain as an income in retirement. So, because we had heard all the stuff in the press about what would happen if you extended out the age pension age to 70, and we've done some modelling just to see what that would look like and how that affects things. So, at the moment, this chart is just what we looked at before. So, based on the pension starting at 65, but then this is what would happen if you're actually starting the pension from 70. So what it means is you're going to have that we're assuming the person's going to have a higher drawdown in the first 5 years because they're going to have to draw down more from their super to still maintain that comfortable lifestyle that they're looking for. And then because they've drawn down their super more quickly, they're going to actually have a heavier reliance on the age pension thereafter than they would have under the original scenario. In this case, the super lasts to about age 86, so right on the male life expectancy, but actually slightly below for the female life expectancy. And so more than half the people are going to end up on complete reliance on the age pension once they get past their life expectancy, if they're the lucky half to survive that long. And similarly, this is adding in the other assets. Again, high drawdowns from super lasting to about 97, so we actually looked at the other one, it's about 98, so it doesn't make a big deal of difference at this. And in the final year, though, where the super is exhausted, the level of the comfortable income cannot be sustained because you actually draw down the rest of your super, you don't have enough, and you're just getting the age pension. Oh, sorry, I should have shown you that earlier. So that's how that moves. And so then this is the same thing on how quickly does the super balance run down. And so what this shows is that really we're moving the ages where the super's going to run out to a bit earlier. More so on the where you've only got an age pension, no other assets, because you're probably going to have your super run out about 3 years earlier than otherwise. If you do have other assets outside super, it doesn't make so much of a difference. It was about 1 year on these assumptions. So I'll pass on to Peter again. He can just talk about where do we think we'll go to next.
So just a few final comments before we go to questions. I think we're broadly on track. This slide asks the question where to next. So, arguably both the UK system and our system are not quite sustainable. We've got people retiring with lowish balances, at least for the next 20 or plus years, very high reliance on the age pension. UK's had the opposite with their DB sort of pension type of arrangements where extreme pressure on corporates and balance sheets. So, and then they've also just recently made the announcement about moving away from the compulsory annuitisation. So where we end up, I suppose, is a good question. I don't think we're going to get to that answer today. But the real danger, I think, from my point of view, is do we end up with the worst of both and not the best of both? And I'm sure that'll be a continuing debate around policy for some time. But it certainly is an interesting time, I think, in the world of super. The next topic is, what should we do? So this is a few thoughts from Deloitte. We're about to release a much more detailed paper, but here's just a few points which we'll go into in much more detail. But what might be some fairly sensible things that we could do to try to improve the system? So and we've broken it into what the government might be able to do and what funds might be able to do. So in terms of the government side of things, we're practical, encourage people to work beyond 65. Obviously that won't be for everyone, but we're practical. And increase employment of older Australians. So companies being able to better utilise people as they get older and not sort of just recycle them and exit them. Encourage higher contributions and address some of those issues around contribution caps, which is something I think would make a big improvement. Simple and easy access to independent advice is crucial. Facilitate access to deferred and lifetime annuities, which is clearly one the actuaries hold close to their hearts. And allowing for integration with a pension and trying to stop some of that leakage out of the super system, which at the moment is more than probably is sustainable. And I think the last one there is quite important as well. Gradually de-emphasise the features that allow members to be passive. We've done lots of obviously very good things in super and you know, My Super, Stronger Super is probably the most recent one of those. But possibly have we gone a bit too far down the path of trying to cater too much so that people don't have to make a decision, and for essentially the whole system's catering for people not having to make a decision rather than trying to turn that around and get people to proactively think about their retirement and actually, I don't know if we want to go as far as force people to make a decision, but in some cases that actually might not be such a bad thing. On the fund side of things, most of these, I think you'd agree, are probably reasonably sensible, and they're all around that thing of understanding your members and really getting across your membership. So recognise that retirees are multi-segmented. They're very different, and there's not a one-size-fits-all. Education is critical, and the whole thing around investment and product, and I'm sure we'll hear more about that over the course of the next few days. I think we would probably, as an industry, have to agree that the GFC, we didn't help retirees as part of the GFC, and if we didn't believe that, I'm not sure we're on the right page. So we need to do better for retirees, and there's products and investment type options and things too. In this day and age of sophistication, I'm sure there's better options there. Learn from the success of SMSFs and provide those features, and that links back to the leakage out of the system as well. And use the purchasing power to deliver added value benefits, and that clearly needs to link into ageing and health and whether there's partnerships between funds and health providers and those sorts of things, which, in fact, I think we've seen recently with Equip Super, I think it was, and one of the health providers. So that was our very quick snapshot of some areas for improvement, and we will be putting out a much more detailed paper very soon. So I think that was the end of our presentation, and we might go to questions. Yep.
Thank you. Okay, question time. We have a few minutes, and I'll take the chair's prerogative to ask the first one. Thank you for the graph of moving the age pension eligibility out to age 70. Just having a quick, but you still had them retiring at 65, and there weren't any numbers on it, so that's fine. But just looking at the area that you were colouring in green, very quickly it looked to me like it might actually cost the government more than currently leaving where it is. So one of the consequences surely must be, to make the system sustainable, that we're going to have to stop people drawing superannuation money full stop until age 70. Otherwise that system's not going to work. And it's the opposite of what I said in the Fin Review on Saturday.
I don't think that we could stop people from drawing down their super to 70. I know that some of the debate's actually about trying to link the preservation age to the age pension eligibility and say a five-year gap, and I think that's reasonable. If you keep forcing people to have super that they still cannot access for a longer period of time when it's meant to fund retirement, that's almost saying that people cannot retire till 70, mm-hmm. when then what would that imply is actually probably more dependence on social security, disability pensions, New Start, things like that, where people aren't able to get a work if they
I think that's a fair comment. But it's not a simple answer, is it? A very complex answer, actually. Okay, open to questions, please. Yes, please.
I've just got a question. It's about leakage out of the system. And you talked about the amount of leakage there is now. One of the things that concerns me is counterparty risk. So if you look at, we are going to have a better product, and it's easy to think of better product design, that there would be very few financial institutions, whether they're banks or insurance companies, that if you retire at 65 or 70 with an expectancy of 20 or 25 years, that are going to remain in their current form for that 20 or 25 years. And we're not going to look back at the last 20 or 25 years and see the number of mergers or defaults on a global scale. So my question really is, do you think that the government in any way will act as a backstop, or that there will be some sort of premium charged by the government to those financial institutions to support them, so that people will feel comfortable about taking counterparty risk on the institutions they're buying the product from?
Good question. I suppose at least a few points there. At the moment, at least, most of the post-retirement stuff is more allocated pension, drawdown-y stuff, so I think it has less of the issue that you're talking about the more annuity lifetime type products. So I think where that certainly the government and the industry has to, you can't do one without the other there. So if the government was to introduce some sort of compulsory annuitisation, could they, we've just recently, I suppose, seen operational risk reserves, and funds have to put a little bit aside to fund those sort of reserves. Would they have some other sort of reserve? Is that the sort of thing you're possibly getting at? Like a fund set up to meet?
I'm thinking of, if you are encouraging product by the wealth managers or, banks or the insurance companies, if you really want to have annuity products available that people can buy, there wouldn't be many financial institutions that people would be happy to take 20 or 25 year risk on at the moment. And
yep.
Confident if they put their 500,000 or 1 million that they're going to exist, that not one of those is going to default over that time period.
I'm not sure I know the answer to that question. I think Australians have a mindset issue at the moment, which is possibly the single biggest hurdle to get around, that we just have been in a lump sum culture for so long, and the thought of giving someone my life savings, even though it may make complete sense from an economic point of view, I think we've got to get around that first, to be honest, rather than counterparty risk type issues, which is a real issue, and I don't discount that at all, but I think these just broader mindset issues for the Australian public about these type of products, I think, first.
maybe I can just add to that, Peter. I, with Michael Sherris, wrote the chapter in the Henry Report, looking at failure of annuity markets, and that's a point that comes out. Why have they failed? Because of this guarantee on the extremes. I found no political will at all from either side to actually even address the issue. Got nowhere. It's not even on the radar. No will at all. Unfortunately, quote a politician who I won't name, superannuation loses you votes, it doesn't get you votes. Next question. Yes?
Just with talking about the...
Sorry, could you speak up just a bit?
Just talking about the success of SMSFs, just where you think they're going in the future. And you were saying with things to do is provide access to SMSF type features. Mm. What features?
Yeah, I think... So the slide which sort of looked out 10 years from now but was very much just focused on retirement, I think if that slide was more generally focused on superannuation, I think we're clearly going to see the retail players and the industry funds trying to stop that flow out of into SMSF. So, and so we're already seeing a lot of that with member direct investment options, which are probably one of the biggest attractions to SMSF, so I suspect that will become more sophisticated, which is probably the biggest one. In terms of the tax structures and things which people are attracted to SMSFs, I suppose that's maybe another big one. I don't know if the bigger funds have fully got around that one yet, but I'm sure it's such a lucrative area that's just bound to happen soon. The other interesting thing with the SMSFs is that a huge amount of money went into them some time ago. A lot of those people are getting quite a bit older, so I suspect there's actually possibly a tipping point at some point where there's going to be people with large SMSFs but they're 80 and they're starting to actually get to the point where I don't really want to have a self-managed fund anymore. I don't want the effort, the hassle, the complexity of it. I actually want to go back the other way and back into a more pooled vehicle and just let them deal with all that stuff. So there's all sorts of interesting forces around that SMSF segment, I think. But I think the big retail and industry fund players are going to certainly come up with a solution that essentially allows people to do everything they could in an SMSF.
Yes, please.
I just had a comment on the SMSF and then a question. One of the beauties of the SMSFs is they're very simple. It's like a bank account. You put your money in, you own it, you can see it, you sign off on it. Now, the industry funds and the retail market will never be able to replicate that. Now, no matter what they do, they will never replicate the simplicity of the SMSF. So, I mean, just adding, I think it's a matter of trust, and people who don't trust the system and all the reserves that are being built up in these funds, they feel as though their money's dissipated through the investment managers, perhaps the insurers, perhaps the admin fee, and what you get with an SMSF is a lot more transparency. But I think that's why they will continue to grow and develop.
At the risk of showing myself up to be completely stupid, I actually have an SMSF, and by the time the accountants are finished with it, I have no idea what they're doing. Be honest with you, it is really complicated, and I'm supposed to be an expert. Now, yeah, and I think they're really hard to understand. You're going to get all these forms filled out, and by the time you read them, it's virtually impossible to read the tax returns. But anyway, look. I think I was talking to Aruna Bay, who chairs IPAC, and he was saying that this control issue, their research is showing up, this control issue of SMSFs is the driver. And people are even prepared to pay more than they should to run these things. It's a control feature.
I think that's right. I think as an advisor, seeing people who have them for the right reasons and many who have them for the wrong reasons, the control issue, the two big ones are control and trust. I wouldn't call them simple. They might be simple to the likes of us, but as you say, the paper that comes through is just amazing. And there are solutions. I mean, wrap accounts, and if you're talking about industry funds becoming like wrap accounts, which can go 95% of the way to doing what a self-managed super fund does, well, there's a lot of development and expense involved in getting that sort of functionality, but, if that's if that's what it's got to be, then that's not...
That's expensive.
But it's expensive, and kind of then what is the industry fund doing? Is it a low-cost solution, or is it trying to be all things to all people?
I think there's another driver sitting in the back of the SMFS, which we probably don't recognise all that well. It's a lot of income for a lot of accountants.
Sure.
There's a vested interest sitting in there, I think.
There's an economic efficiency point there somewhere.
Yep.
And you know, some people say it's 200,000. I think it's a million, but you know, it's a whole range of different views as to what's the right point. And it still comes down to motivation.
Yeah, I think you're right.
Well.
Yeah. So we don't know the answer to that one. What's next?
Oh, I did have a question.
Oh, sorry. Yes.
Mr. Chair. Now, I was interested in your comment that you're going to try and encourage savings into super. Now, we already had massive tax concessions to get people to save. So what in addition, do you think we need? Are they just phenomenally attractive tax concessions that they sit? People don't use them. I don't know that that's going to help. So have you got some other ideas?
Well, one of the issues is actually that there are tax concessions, but people can't make best use of them. So the whole idea of having an annual contribution cap and $30,000 is not enough. That you know, when people are actually buying homes, trying to pay off mortgages, send the kids to school, they can't afford to make best use of that. And then when they have got the kids out of the home and are best able, they're restricted by how much they can pay to, into super to take advantage of that. So the concept of things like having a lifetime cap, almost back to the old RBL days, but something like that, that you can actually make full use of that, some of the ways to actually try to encourage people to have more in super. Because one of my concerns is we look at it and we can see that, you can rely on the age pension, but there must be a point where the government, the government's already looking and saying can't afford it. But it's always very reactive. And so if you're still looking at another 20 years before you retire, can you depend upon that age pension to really be there to support you?
I guess I'm not signing up about $30,000 cap. There's a $450,000 cap, in fact, and it's enormous. And it's still got great tax concessions. So you roll into investment free income, investment free roll-ups.
And that's actually an area where I can see that the government may do something about because of those concessions that you get on the investment income. So that would be fair enough because a lot of the challenge around super being for the rich and everything like that is around those sort of things where you can put in a lot of those large lump sums into a concessional environment.
Last question. We do have to wind up. I heard the little bell. Well, I've got the last question in that case. I think it was 7.6 trillion you were estimating. Doesn't matter what it is, it's a large number. What do you think the market capacity to supply securities to take that in is going to be like? Have you done any work on that side of things? Because we did run into a problem early on with the SGL where there was clearly asset inflation coming through. There just wasn't supply. One of the reasons we have a fixed... thank goodness we do have a fixed a government debt market. The government was going to cut out the debt market and they kept it going just to supply securities.
Yeah.
I wonder sometimes where the 7.6 trillion is going to be invested in an efficient manner.
China.
China. Okay, on that point I think let me thank Peter and Diane for their great presentation. Thank you.